This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Matthew Hayes, one of the hosts of this channel. Today, I'm joined by Rebecca Copeland and Linda Ehrlich to chat about their new co-edited and co-written book titled Yamamba, In Search of the Japanese Mountain Witch, which is out this year on Stonebridge Press. This book is a unique collection of scholarly and creative writings surrounding the figure of Yamamba, or the Japanese Mountain Witch. It traces the contours of historical, theatrical, folkloric, gendered, and imaginary manifestations of this witch figure, and does so through 10 chapters. Some of these chapters were contributed by the co-editors themselves, which we'll chat about today, while others were contributed by scholars and writers and performers, all working through some connection to this mysterious figure, Yamamba. Readers, I think, will appreciate this interdisciplinary and genre-bending collection of works that pushes us to rethink much of what we think we know about Yamamba, but also and more generally about representations of the marginalized female archetype in cultural imaginations worldwide. Rebecca and Linda, welcome to the show, and thank you very, very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
I wonder if we could just begin here by having each of you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do, how you became interested in Japanese studies as a discipline, and how you arrived to where you are now, if that's okay.
Hi, I'll start. I'm Linda Ehrlich. I'm a visiting faculty member at Duke University here in Durham, and also associate professor emerita from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. And I write about Japanese film and about Japanese traditional theater. My PhD is actually from University of Hawaii and the East-West Center, where I did a lot of Asian theater. And I've been a guest speaker for the Theater Nogaku, which is a troupe based in the U.S. with members from Japan and England as well. And I'm also a published poet. was very intrigued by this topic. Rebecca actually had approached me about it, and I'm very happy to be part of it.
Well, I'm Rebecca Copeland, and I'm very delighted to be joining you, Matthew and Linda, for this discussion. I'm a professor of Japanese literature at Washington University in St. Louis, and my research primarily focuses on women, Japanese women writers of the modern era. I also translate and have translated the works of Kirino Natsuo and Uno Chiyo. And more recently, I've been delving into creative writing myself and have recently published The Kimono Tattoo, a mystery novel with Brother Mockingbird Press. This venture with Linda has also been one that has, as you noted in the introduction, combined creative energies with academic. So this is really down my new alley, I guess. And I got interested in Japanese literature just sort of by accident, I guess. I was born in Japan. But within months of my birth, or actually weeks of my birth, was my parents relocated to North Carolina, actually not too far from where y'all are. I grew up in Wake Forest, the little town of Wake Forest, and was just very lucky to have had the opportunity to go back to Japan when I was a junior in college on a study abroad. And prior to that, I hadn't really paid much attention to Japan other than trying to figure out how to spell Fukuoka when I had to write my birthplace on school applications and things like that. But being in Japan when I was in my early 20s was just so transforming. And after that first year, I decided I just have to study more about Japan. And I went to graduate school and intended to get an MA. And the next thing I know, I was working towards a PhD and then ended up in academic as a professor. So it just sort of evolved.
It's funny how those things tend to snowball quite naturally sometimes. Right. Thank you very much for those introductions. I think, you know, before turning to your book, I wonder if you could help listeners understand more about this figure, Yamamba, before we really get into the details. And I think one of the patterns I noticed throughout the writing here is that this figure is difficult to describe in a very clean and neat and categorical way. I think that's one of the compelling qualities, actually, of this figure. But as co-editors of this book, you know, I wonder if you could try to describe or define Yamamba for our listeners as best you can so that they have some idea of the maybe qualities or attributes and representations of the Japanese mountain witch, if that's okay.
Well, as you said, it's very difficult to define. I think describe might be easier. Yamamba is an old woman in the mountains. Those two qualities are essential. She's awesome. In Japanese, I would say ikameshi. She's majestic like the mountains. She can be helpful. She can be a figure of pathos. And she can be a grotesque figure and a frightening figure. I was recently speaking to a Japanese woman in her 90s who's lived in Tennessee most of her life, adult life. And when I mentioned Yamamba, she said, she's frightening. We all thought when we were little that she was frightening. Yamamba's a figure of folklore, of mythology, and as you pointed out, of theater, both no and kabuki. And as our book shows, she's still relevant to contemporary times in many new guises.
Yeah, so I'll just jump in.
I was going to say, yeah, Rebecca, if you would like to add to that, please go ahead.
Oh, sure. To sort of continue what where Linda was going with the contemporary, I think contemporary Japanese women writers began to appropriate the Yamamba image, the awesomeness of her and the powerfulness of the Yamamba, but also the sense of ostracism that we find in the Yamamba, the sense of sort of being chased away into the mountains and the notion that powerful creative women are somehow aberrant and fearsome. And so I think contemporary women or contemporary artists have found in this image a sense of identification, and that has fueled their creativity. And I think that's one of the directions that Linda and I were heading in with this collection. Mm.
Great. Yeah. I think it's helpful to have at least some image and some kind of baseline understanding of who this figure is, or perhaps what this figure is, and some of the ways that I think it plays out for folks in their own mind and imagination. And frightening certainly is one of the qualities that I actually found to be quite present in the book throughout. So I'm glad to hear that was the same for you, Rebecca. I'd like to turn to the book now, if I could, which I find, as I was describing a little bit earlier, you know, very daring and dynamic and entertaining in some portions, and very, very fun to read, in fact. So there were many moments during my reading experience that I wondered about how something like this emerged and took shape, because I think it defies a lot of the categorical tendencies we have to genre and to discipline in the world mm-hmm. of publishing. And I consumed this book actually in two sittings, and I found myself kind of propelled along by a real curiosity about what would come in the next chapter and how Yamamba would be portrayed differently, right, from the chapter I was currently reading. So perhaps you could describe for our listeners, you know, a little bit about what this book is, how you conceived of it, how it came together, maybe how you selected some of the contributing authors, and really what it sets out to do in your mind.
Well, that's great to hear about your reading experience, Matthew. That's really wonderful. I wish I could say in my memory that we sat down and had mapped out a very, very clear plan. The book just evolved. I'm very comfortable with this mixture of the scholarly and the so-called creative, although I think scholarship, of course, is also creative. And Rebecca is really fearless, I think. And we just did it. Now, in terms of finding the other people, that also evolved. I mean, I remembered that one of our contributors, Ann Sheriff, who is a professor at Oberlin University, her host family in Japan, when she was a foreign student there, are mother and daughter no performers, professional no performers. So I thought about contacting her, and she came up with this wonderful interview of her host mother and host sister. And then we also started to realize that we needed an introduction that was, you know, informative background material. So it just kind of, as we experienced needs, we looked for people to write, and we spoke to people about it. I just really can't remember the process too well anymore. It was a long process. It didn't happen overnight. We had a lot of discussions. I think we worked together really well. I appreciated that. And then we, you know, we put the book out, and I think at some point we'll talk about reception, but I was quite apprehensive about the reception of this book, but I was wrong. We've really gotten great reviews.
If I may, I like the way Linda has sort of characterized the book as just evolving. There's a line in the no play Yamamba, and I can't remember it very well, so I'll just sort of paraphrase, and Linda may be able to add more detail. But the Yamamba herself is described as sort of emerging out of the earth, or the nature of the mountain, just kind of evolving. And I see that as analogous to our process as well. We had a seed, we had an idea, and it just began to grow. And in the end became this book. Both Linda and I have long been interested in the image, the icon, photography of the Yamamba. And we were both working on Yamamba things simultaneously. And it's interesting that we found each other. I mean, we already knew each other by name, but we found each other on Facebook. Okay. I mean, Facebook is getting some bad rap, but it does provide some interesting conduits between people. So Linda was working on a Yamamba project, her poem, and I was working on a sort of personal art project, and I posted my thing, Linda posted her thing, and so we decided, hey, let's put our Yamamba energies together and do something more with this. And at the same time, a Japanese choreographer named Yasuko Yokoshi, who appears in the book, was working on a choreography that involved the Yamamba. And so she reached out to me, having come across an article I'd written that dealt with Yamamba. And, you know, it just sort of grew from there. I knew some people that I wanted to include. Of course, Mizuta Noriko has, a renowned Japanese feminist of literature, and a poet herself. She has done a lot of work on Yamamba and also has translated the short story that we included by Oba Minako, who was one of these writers who appropriated the Yamamba image. So it just grew together. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I think we both were very moved by the Oba Minako story. I have taught it in a class on Japanese women writers. And that became kind of a touchstone for us. And also for me, the No play by Zayami. And then I felt strongly that we needed some images, but I didn't want any, you know, I don't know, there was a certain kind of image I did not want. And I was fortunate that I remembered actually a woman who was my former student and then has gone on to be a very promising young artist in Cleveland. And she did a lot of the images for the book, as well as the photographs that that Anne Sheriff's subjects and the contemporary dancer contributed. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, Linda, what types of images you were trying to avoid? I find the cover of this book actually I find particularly attractive. I think it's a very interesting kind of juxtaposition between the sort of photographic forested trees and the kind of, you know, loose sketch kind of semi-opaque behind. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, there are images throughout the book as well. But what were you trying to avoid, if I could ask?
Well, the cover image and these what we call kind of the interlude images are by Maria Alalovic, who is this young artist. And the design is very nice. It's done by Stonebridge Press, and I was very pleased by their design work. I mean, the images I wanted to avoid reflect more my taste. It's not that there was anything right or wrong with them, but I don't like the kind of sensationalized, sexualized images that sometimes we see. And I honestly don't like the word witch, but I knew that it was unavoidable.
That's interesting. Yeah. And, you know, hearing how this project came together, again, sort of looking at the table of contents and looking at all of the pieces hanging together, I mean, it's very clear that there were many, many moving parts at any given time as this project came together. So it's amazing to hear how it developed quite naturally, at least it sounds like. Great. So, you know, one of the things I find so compelling about this book is how the themes very gradually and subtly reveal themselves. Mm-hmm. I think the chapters that each of the authors have contributed here are, of course, very distinct from one another, and yet there are very clear through lines that bring these chapters together in impactful and I think very dramatic ways. You know, looking back to my notes here that I was taking while I was reading, I see things like geography and access, gender, interstitial identity, rural peripheries, bodies, physicality, right? All these kind of notes. And I just think as a site of investigation, Yamamba offers such a rich opportunity to unearth kind of tensions and ruptures, not only in Japanese cultural imagination, but also I would say kind of more universally in any given human culture. And this kind of simultaneous depth and breadth through which these themes emerge, I just found to be really captivating. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what themes and motifs you sought to surface very deliberately through these chapters that, you know, again, they're very unique in and of themselves, but they all seem to be kind of pointed to at least a common set of ideas surrounding this figure.
That's a fascinating comment. One thing I wanted to mention, because I'm going to fudge this a bit, because I'm not sure I know about the connecting themes beyond what I've already said, but we did consider this universal aspect, you know, because there are Yamamba-like figures in Ireland, for example, in Eastern Europe, and we decided not to go there. We decided to leave that out, that there was enough just within the Japanese context. And we certainly, as I mentioned, wanted to get some of the informative materials at the beginning and also the classical materials, like about the no play. We wanted to alternate chapters that were poetry and chapters that were narrative. And we did want to end with the most contemporary chapter that we had, which is the one on the contemporary dancer. Beyond that, I think it's a very poetic book. And we did not sit down and map out, in my mind at least, certain themes to highlight. There's nothing like that. So if you're able to pull that out, that is fantastic, you know. And if someone is just also enjoying the variety of writings, I think that's also fine. Because again, we're not trying to make any set definition here. A big question was the glossary and the bibliography. We can talk about that later.
So I think our touchstone was creativity and trying to produce a book that introduced a difficult topic. As we've already discussed, the Yamamba is a topic that is almost impossible to define. So how do you define that? And how do you approach such a topic? And we felt that through creativity, one can learn a lot more or differently, perhaps, than through a straight academic scholarly approach. But we needed Noriko Reader's introduction. We needed some way to set the story for readers who weren't familiar with Yamamba, or even for readers who are familiar with Yamamba. Noriko brings forward a lot of information that I hadn't been aware of. So I think we were looking for different approaches to a creative discourse on the Yamamba. So as Linda pointed out, there was the theatrical, there's the poetic, and also the narrative. And there was the artistic, there were other forms that we would have preferred to have included, but we just were limited by, I guess, the frame of the book and what we could offer. I think probably we each carried with us a notion of what we wanted to see with the Yamamba. And as Linda has sort of implied, she and I don't always have the same image of Yamamba. And so I think we both were bringing forward the kind of Yamamba story we wanted to share. And that might be why the book is so rich with these different thematics that you found, Matthew.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think one thing that's very important to me was engaging the reader and providing some surprises. Now, I was surprised by Laura Miller's Retablo, you know, bringing in the Hispanic culture there. So that's what, you know, one thing I was looking for was this kind of variety in style, in tone, but with, of course, the central focus still the same. Yamamba in the Blue Ridge Mountains, you know, for example, Rebecca's wonderful story. These are all surprises. And I think that makes the book quite engaging. In fact, that was the question about the glossary, you know, how scholarly do we make some of these?
Yeah, I think that's a very that's a very important and I think subtle point, this idea that sort of creative approaches or creative writing or, what we might think of as non-scholarly or non-traditional approaches to a given topic or subject can still impart quite a bit of information. And I found myself stepping away from this book feeling as though I had just consumed a scholarly work in the sense that I felt like I had learned quite a bit, right? I had a very, very kind of comprehensive sense of this figure and some of its kind of, you know, representations and manifestations. And yet all of that came through what is otherwise a very creative and I think very sort of non-traditional approach to a topic. So yeah, I think that's an important point to make. I do want to turn maybe more narrowly here to some of the content. This is a co-edited volume, obviously, and we don't have the other authors here to chat about their contribution. So I'd rather not sort of speak for them and their own writing, but I do want to chat to you both about your contributions to this book. And perhaps we could start with the preface. I just want to pick up on one brief mention of how you distinguish your book from others on a given topic or figure, and describe how your book is not about Yamamba, but for Yamamba. And I have to say that many of the contributions here really did feel like a kind of homage rather than a kind of distanced description or something like this. And so many of the contributions focus on, you know, this kind of interactive nature between the author and Yamamba, right? They're very personal, I think, contributions here, or at least they came across to me that way. So I'm wondering if you can just expand on that idea for listeners. You know, how is this book for this figure rather than about this figure? And why was that important for you to preface this work with that idea?
Rebecca, that was your phrase. Would you like to start?
Okay, sure.
A very good phrase, but...
So the preface, I mean, I think the preface was our opportunity to try to alert readers to the fact that this is not an academic book. Both Linda and I have really identified ourselves as academics, and people who know us will see the book and think that this is an introduction to perhaps the way the Yamamba has figured in art and literature throughout the ages. And we just wanted to let people know from the very beginning, this is a creative enterprise. And the preface was very fun to write because Linda and I have never met.
Oh, really?
We were writing this preface back and forth by sharing drafts on email. And so much of what's going on is intuitive and inspired. And in a way, this whole enterprise was done because Yamamba has inspired us. So this is our, in a way, giving back to this concept, Yamamba, this image, Yamamba, and all that has represented down through the ages. And for me, Yamamba has represented the pain that women have endured because of their power, their creativity, and their enforced silence in many cases. So this is our giving back to that struggle in for me. Yeah.
That's really good. It's an offering of thanks for the example of strength that will continue hopefully forever, and strength of women, of older women who are often ignored. For myself, too, it was a wonderful collaboration. One thing I didn't mention in my introduction was that I first went to Japan when I was 16 as a foreign student, American Field Service foreign student, and I was in Shikoku, and I knew very little Japanese. And my host sister is actually the one who did the Japanese translation of my poem that's in this book. Nice. We had lost touch for many years and then reconnected, and she also did the calligraphy that's on the back cover. And she is a wonderful reciter of poetry in public, and she has recited the poem in English and Japanese to large audiences in Japan. So that's been a very exciting aspect of collaboration for me, thanks to this book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Well, I'm very happy you brought up this issue of translation, Linda. I know a couple of times you've mentioned, and Rebecca has also mentioned, this sort of universality running through this book. And I think there's a real kind of transnational quality as well to many of these chapters. And I think another signal to this kind of maybe transnational importance of a work like this is some of these linguistic qualities that run throughout the book. And I think, one chapter is a translation from Japanese to English, though the original, I think, Japanese is elided in that text. And there's another chapter, Linda, your poetic contribution, Yamamba's Mountains, which moves from English to Japanese, right? And there both languages appear side by side. And beyond these two chapters, I felt a very intentional effort to incorporate quite a lot of Japanese into much of this text, right? Especially in the translations, I think, of the interview portions that appear elsewhere. So, Linda, I think our Japanese studies listeners would really appreciate hearing about how linguistic conventions and considerations shaped your own poetic work in that chapter, and maybe more generally about how these considerations help to inform the content throughout the rest of the book, and maybe even widen the scope of accessibility for readers.
Well, my poem was conceived as a poem in English, but very, very influenced by the No Play. In fact, a few of the phrases are from a translation of the No Play, but of course, changed into a different form. And I worked closely with Kayo on the translation. We went back and forth by email a great deal about that. Anne Sheriff is a magnificent translator, and yet I wanted to have a few more of the original phrases put into the English translation, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And that's when we had to start to think about a glossary. And who is the glossary for? Well, we're expecting a wide readership, not just specialists. So the glossary is really not for specialists, but it could be useful for specialists as well. What to include, what not to include. Rebecca and I had some really interesting discussions on that, where she was much more knowledgeable about some of these contemporary phrases than I was. I'm going, oh, that has to be in the glossary. No, that's, all the time now. So, but I like to have original phrases put in, even if the readers can't, understand them, just make a guess at them when they're necessary. I read things in other languages that have been translated, and you know, maybe I don't know Czech, or maybe I don't know Ukrainian or something like that. But still, it's good. If there's a word that is very hard to translate, then I think it should, you make a stab at it in English, but then you put the original in the parentheses as well.
Did your press have any perspective or give any insight on your inclusion of, you know, what is otherwise a very comprehensive collection of Japanese terms and vocabulary, especially in the glossary as well? I mean, was there any back and forth there?
Oh, yes. I have to say Stonebridge was amazing. I mean, the copy editing they did was really superb. It showed their deep knowledge of Japanese language and Japanese culture. They did not actually want the Japanese in the book. I had to insist that Kayo's translation be put in, or else we would have put in more.
We had a lot of discussion on the romanization of Yamamba.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Right, because the Yamamba with the second M is an old-fashioned romanization that's no longer current. So it would have been more contemporary to have had the Yamamba with the N, Yamamba. So there was some discussion with the press as to whether our astute readers would think we'd made a mistake. But for both of us, we came to our love of this character, this figure, through the old romanization, Yamamba, and it just felt right to have it that way.
And this, there's a third one as well, right?
Yamamba.
That's interesting. I believe I certainly could be wrong about this, but I believe Noriko Reader has a book due out this year that uses that rendering of.
Yes, it's come out for the Utah State University Press, I think. Yeah, it's a very comprehensive study of Yamamba and the derivation, the history of the Yamamba. And she gives just a glimmer of that in her introduction, right? So her book is very, very comprehensive. And again, because of scholars like Noriko Reader, we didn't have to give an academic overview, an overly academic book. That's already been done. So this allowed us the freedom of being more innovative and playful.
Right. And her chapter does have what ended up being endnotes, although most of the others don't. I have to say that with romanization, it's such a tricky thing. I mean, I write about Koreeda, the Japanese director. And of course, his first full-length feature film is Maboroshi, but he wanted it spelled M-A-B-O-R-O. Am I doing this right? M-A-B-O-R-O-S-I, not S-H-I. But so recently I talked to a cinematographer here in Durham, and he's talking about Maboroshi, you know, and I thought, well, you know, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I think this sort of linguistic ambiguity here with Yamamba, I mean, just adds to this overall kind of amorphous quality or characterization of this figure. Yeah. Rebecca, I want to ask you also about your chapter, if I could, which is titled Blue Ridge Yamamba. Having just moved to the American South myself only 2 months ago, I found your treatment here of the Blue Ridge Mountains to be actually quite haunting and frightening. And there are, again, very obvious and clear ties throughout your chapter, and I would argue as well throughout the rest of the book, to geographies, actual and imagined, I think. And so I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about how you see a geography fitting in with this kind of lore surrounding Yamamba, either in your chapter or.
Right. Yes. Thank you. So I have spent a lot of time in the Blue Ridge and hope to return permanently to the Blue Ridge eventually. There's something powerful that emanates from the mountains. And I think this is, again, a universal understanding that mountains signal, as Linda said, majesty, but also magic. And everything in the mountains is changeable, right? The the weather will change at the drop of a hat. The seasons are notably changeable in the mountains. So there's always a sense of wonder and power and uncertainty and danger in the mountains, but a danger that is very natural. And so spending time in the mountains and also spending time in Japan, when I'm in Japan in the mountains and when I'm in North Carolina in the Blue Ridge, I could be either place. You know, when you're in the mountains, you don't necessarily see nationality. You know, the trees might be a little different, but there's something about the mist that occludes this sense of being in a particular country. So with that in mind and having read Oba Minako's Smile of a Mountain Witch, I began to feel that the Yamamba is not a character that is limited to any particular place or time. The Yamamba is timeless, and the Yamamba is really part of whoever is encountering her. And so let me back up and say, I recently taught the story, The Smile of a Mountain Witch, in my class here at Washington University. And as we're reading the story, my students were saying, but is she real? Is she really a Yamamba? The story is about a woman who presents herself as a Yamamba, and we learn of her girlhood and how she has to sort of suppress her magic so that she can be acceptable for society. And I'm trying to express to the students that perhaps all women who have had to suppress their magic are potentially Yamamba. And since understanding that, I thought of trying to write a story that depicted an American woman encountering her own Yamamba in the Blue Ridge.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing. And I think so many of these chapters deal with natural phenomena in such an upfront and dramatic way that it's really, really difficult to distinguish this figure from her natural surroundings, right? Whether they are mountains or forest, or in the case of some of these chapters, right, urban environments and things like this. So, yeah, there is a real kind of universality, I think, to this terrain and geography, but also the kind of atmospheric seasons and sort of natural, the other kind of natural phenomena that occur in these spaces. So, yeah, very, very interesting to hear about that. Linda, is there anything you'd like to add there just on this issue of geography running throughout the book?
I was just thinking about Kurosawa's film Dreams, which of course has some good sequences and some that aren't so great, but there is the Yuki Onna sequence, you know, the snow woman. And in that sequence, she starts out being sort of nice, but then becomes really, really terrifying, which is a snowstorm that's going to kill all the men who are hiking. I think Yamamba is more complex than that depiction, in fact. So what Rebecca just said was beautiful. I agree with it completely. And once I started working on this book, I started to see many of these themes in different geographical places.
And of course, in David Holloway's story, the Yamamba is a little more terrifying.
Right.
Won't give anything away, but yeah. So I think in our book as well, we have the Yamamba as nurturer, the Yamamba as teacher, the Yamamba as vulnerable, the Yamamba who suffers, and the Yamamba who's ferocious and who mets out judgment.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of parallel there, I would say, to the, again, the sort of terrains and environments and outdoor natural spaces that punctuate this work. And as you just described, the range of qualities and temperaments and dispositions of this figure, right? Both of those, I think, are varied
And I think she's very tied to seasonal changes as well. Mm-hmm. In my poem, I try to get this sense of a cyclic, of cycles. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. she emerges from the darkness and she goes back into the darkness. Mm-hmm. So that adds a different temporal aspect, which of course is the aspect of the mountains.
Perhaps we could turn now to reception. This is something that was mentioned just briefly or earlier in our conversation. I just want to turn to audience here and how you envisioned it, if at all, from the start. I think, again, one of the compelling qualities of this book is really the way it seems to cut across so many disciplinary boundaries. And as I read, I imagined the range of students and researchers working in so many sub-disciplines within Japanese studies, getting so much out of this book. It really brings together, as we've said here many times, historical writing, creative writing, ethnographic writing, and others, and I think these emerge in contexts, certainly not limited to things like folklore studies, performance studies, gender studies, cultural studies, right, and even art and geography, as we just described in some of these other contexts. So, if I could just ask you both, who is this book for, and how do you imagine it being consumed, and in what context?
Well, as a writer, I tend to just want to do the writing or the editing, the compiling, the curating. And then you think about the audience, but I'm not the kind of person who writes just for a certain audience, but I was apprehensive. There's no doubt about it. I felt a lot like the Spanish director Luis Buñuel when he first showed An Andalusian Dog, his most experimental film, and he put rocks in his pocket just in case he'd have to stone the audience that they would be in a riot. And so I was really, I'll have to say, shocked by the response from very well-known scholars, from people who work more in pop culture. We just got a great review in the Yale News, all over the place. So I'm still in a state of surprise.
Well, I think I agree with Linda that we write and we create, and then we don't necessarily think about the audience. But when we were seeking a publisher, I think we did have an audience in mind. We didn't want to go with the traditional academic press because we just didn't think this book was, that's not who it was meant for. So we were very delighted when Stonebridge Press was so open-minded about the book, and we contacted them while the book was in progress, so we didn't have the complete volume. And I think Stonebridge has an audience that's much more eclectic, that reaches beyond the classroom, and I was hoping that we'd have people who don't necessarily know about Japan, who are interested in poetry, who are interested in folklore, as you say, but not necessarily for teaching or academic purposes, who just want to read and learn something that touches them. But I also can see that this book would have utility in the classroom. Linda's poetry combined with Anne Sheriff's interview would be wonderful for people who are working on Japanese theater or performance. Laura Miller's essay nods towards contemporary fashion and contemporary behavior among young women in Japan. So I think there's something in there for everybody. For me, I want my students to be able to read the book and think, I can also express myself creatively. So many students feel stymied by the genre of academic writing. I don't know how to write well and so forth and so on. And I think if they had more samples of, or more models for alternative ways of sharing their knowledge, they might do better. So hopefully this book will also spark some creativity amongst our students.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and with any book, there comes a certain point where you just have to wrap it up. And that's what we did. But we can imagine other kinds of essays, other kinds of poems, short stories. So this is what I hope is a strong beginning. Maybe not always about Yamamba, but about any subject matter.
That's right.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to hear. In my reading experience, it was very difficult for me not to imagine the utility of this book in the classroom. I mean, I taught a class myself last year on Japanese folklore. In fact, I used parts of Dreams, believe it or not, in the classroom. But I mean, this book would have fit in so many ways, in a class like that and certainly other classes. It's interesting to hear that you, sounds like, you know, very intentionally avoided an academic press for your own reasons. And yet it was quite well received and continues to be quite well received within, what we might call very traditional squarely academic forums and contexts. So it sounds like maybe you were surprised a bit by that. And I wonder, do you think that says anything about some of the changing perspectives within the academy about things like genre and, interdisciplinarity and the way it sort of manifests in works like this?
Yeah, I do. I think that there is, much more emphasis now on crossing boundaries, on interdisciplinarity, and on alternative tracks in academia, so that we're not just focused on erudite performance, but on new avenues to knowledge production. And I see this, I hope this book will open more doors, as Linda said, to other ways of approaching academic topics.
I mean, there comes a point with writing, I feel, that if you want to do it, you just do it, and it's very important to find a good home for it. And Stonebridge Press was a very good home for it. Other books will have other kinds of homes, but if you're always worrying about, does it fit into this box or that box, it will never be good writing.
Well, I mean, I have to say, I would not have done this if I didn't have tenure. So, if I had been an untenured professor, this would have been a risk. And, how would it count and where would I put it on my CV? And I feel like Linda and I have the luxury of not needing to worry about that.
That's very, very interesting to hear. I mean, well, clearly the risk has paid off. And I think this book is being very well appreciated by quite a range and spectrum of folks on either side of the academic divide. We are just about out of time here. This has been a very, very wonderful and interesting conversation. Maybe before we say goodbye, perhaps you could tell our listeners a little bit about what you're working on now, or maybe what you might have planned for future projects. I think you alluded to this sort of in the context of Yamamba, but yeah, please feel free to let us know what else you're working on.
Well, I've just finished doing an awful lot of work about Corrieta, including an essay that just came out about his so-called French film, The Truth. And I want to put together a collection of lyric essays, new writing, and also some selected writing. And I don't have any home for it. So I'm kind of just, moving away from the shore a bit with this one. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, well, I still have my feet in, one foot in the academic world and one foot in creative writing. So I'm working on promoting the Kimono Tattoo, the novel, mystery novel that's set. It's set in contemporary Kyoto. But I'm also working on a handbook of modern and contemporary Japanese women writers. I'll be the curator of the handbook, the editor, and there will be about 20 or so chapters of different aspects of Japanese women's writing. I think it's going to be very exciting. That should come out in a few years, so that'll be a while. And I'm still very interested in Uno Chiyo. That's the Japanese writer that I wrote my dissertation on. I'm hoping to try to put together a book about her called Bad Girls of Good Housekeeping, because she was a bit scandalous, never could stay married, and yet was constantly being asked for advice from married women on how to keep their husbands. Or she wrote cookbooks, and of course she was a famous kimono designer, so I see her as a good housekeeper, but maybe not a good wife.
That's fascinating. And one of the essays I want to write is about the Seto Naikai, the Japan Inland Sea, because that ties back to my first time in Japan when I went across it at dusk, when I knew almost no Japanese. And so I'd like to revisit it. Excuse me. I'd like to revisit the Seto Naikai and also respond to another book that's a Stonebridge Press book by Donald Ritchie, which is about the Inland Sea. Oh. And Donald was a mentor of mine. So yeah, I think I'm at a point in my life where I'm trying to weave different aspects together like this.
Great. And very nice to see you still interacting with your press in that way. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a nice sort of keep it in the family. Wonderful. Well, I think certainly for me, and I suspect our listeners as well, I think we'll all look forward to those projects you've just listed there. And that sounds like very exciting work you both have planned for the future.
Thank you.
Rebecca and Linda, this has been an absolute pleasure for me. I just want to thank you both very, very much for taking the time out to speak to our listeners about this wonderful and very exciting and dynamic contribution to not just the field of Japanese studies, but I would say, as I think has been made clear here, several fields and subfields. Again, the book is titled Yamamba, In Search of the Japanese Mountain Witch. It is out now on Stonebridge Press, and I'm sure other readers will be as enthralled and surprised as I was, and maybe even a little frightened along the way. So, thank you very much for your time, both of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your careful reading.
This has been delightful.
Great. My pleasure. Thank you. Take good care.